Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
At William & Mary, we believe today's business education needs to be more than just innovative. It requires a legacy of success, a focus on teaching, an emphasis on technology, and a practical hands-on approach. At William & Mary's Raymond A. Mason School of Business, our online, part-time, and traditional full-time graduate programs apply these strengths to provide the experience necessary to help you succeed. Visit us at chatadmissions.com to learn more.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and this edition is published in the early hours of Sunday, the 21st of June. Our main stories. As we record this podcast, President Trump returns to the campaign trail with a rally in Tulsa, even though six of his staff have tested positive for COVID-19. Meanwhile, the White House has lost its bid to block the publication of John Bolton's memoirs. And Spain allows British travellers to visit the country, like EU nationals, without quarantine restrictions. Also in the podcast...
The moment when it was destroying my crops, it was very difficult to see it happen in front of my eyes. It felt like somebody was cutting off a part of my body.
Pakistan braces itself for more attacks by locusts. The United States may still be in the grip of the COVID-19 pandemic, but Donald Trump has decided not to wait any longer to return to the campaign trail as he bids for re-election. A million people are reported to have applied for the 19,000 tickets available for his first post-lockdown rally. Attendees at the event on Saturday night in Tulsa, Oklahoma, had to sign waivers protecting the organisers from responsibility for any coronavirus-related illnesses. And in fact, six of the president's staff in Tulsa have tested positive for COVID-19. But these supporters are not worried.
Tulsa has very few COVID cases. So we don't have a lot of COVID here, but nobody ever talks about the numbers.
If I get it, I think I'll survive 99.7% recovery rate. There ain't no concern about COVID and race rallies right now. You know what I'm saying? There's no concern in that. So, no, I'm good. I'm clean.
Lise Doucette spoke about the rally to Dr. Eric Fagel-Ding, an epidemiologist and senior fellow of the Federation of American Scientists.
My greatest fear is that it is a combination of indoor plus a tendency that most Trump supporters and conservatives do not like to wear masks and believe it's some sort of weakness or conspiracy against Trump, that combined with no mask and indoors will lead to a potential super spreading event. And these people are coming from all across the country, all across. This is one of the largest rallies and one of the first he's had in months. And it will just not only spread to so many people, but they will bring it home to across the country. And it's these kind of events that you always want to avoid, but yet here we are.
And what about the particular concerns about the venue, Tulsa, Oklahoma? We know that the virus has had different impact in different states. What about Oklahoma?
Oklahoma, based on our research group's analysis, has actually spiked up 140%. So 2.5-fold increase since last week. And so Oklahoma right now is one of the hotspots. In addition, many other places, Texas is nearby, also having hotspots, resurgence, Arizona, the entire Southern Sun Belt is having resurgence. And this is so worrisome because this is, at the moment, the worst timing and the worst venue and the worst combination of indoors plus non-mask wearing, mass disinclined population shouting at a rally. So altogether, it is the perfect storm.
And why is there this resurgence now in the states that you mentioned?
Because a lot of these states had reopened very quickly. And some states reopened, but there's a very strong mask wearing culture in a lot of the New England states because they've seen how bad it is. But in certain ways, rural areas previously weren't hit that badly. So if you don't see it, you don't believe it. And so when finally the reopening happened around end of May, now 2 or 3 weeks later, we're in the tail end of all these cases coming about. And especially in the South, where, again, there's a anti-mask wearing culture in a huge swath of the population.
Now, you've taken to President Trump's communication tool of choice, and that's to Twitter, to warn people not to attend. You've used please beg any friends, you know, not to attend the rally. You've urged the organizers to cancel it. Have you also spoken, or scientists or officials that you know, have they spoken to the organizers, spoken to the White House, pleading with them not to have this rally?
Yeah, I've tried to communicate with some local elected officials, and there are people within the city who've actually tried to sue to stop the rally. But the Oklahoma Supreme Court actually blocked and rejected that claim. I'm just shaking my head as an epidemiologist, because we worked so hard to stop this epidemic. And we were so close to stopping it. And yet right now we reopened way too quickly. They're not wearing masks and they congregate together shouting loudly. And we know that shouting and singing leads to huge epidemics. The American people are going to suffer. And I think the buck should stop at the top.
Dr. Eric Fagel-Ding. Donald Trump had earlier fired off a series of angry tweets about his former national security adviser, John Bolton, saying he'd broken the law and would pay a big price. The White House has been trying to prevent the publication of Mr. Bolton's memoir, in which he accuses the president of asking China to help him get re-elected. But a US judge rejected the request. Our correspondent Peter Bowes told us more about the ruling.
This is obviously concerning the book, The Room Where It Happened, a White House memoir. And the judge has denied the request for an injunction. The White House, the administration, wanted that to stop the book going on sale next Tuesday. But in the detail of the ruling by the judge, he seems essentially to agree with the argument that was put forward by the Trump administration, that in writing the book and in not seeing through the process of vetting that he was involved in with the White House, that Mr. Bolton has raised grave national security concerns. And in that respect, Donald Trump, because he's tweeted about it, we know he sees this as, to quote him, a big court win against Mr. Bolton.
Peter Bowes. Several people have been stabbed in a park in the English town of Reading, and there are reports it may be terror-related. A man, reported to be a Libyan national, has been arrested. I heard the latest from our reporter, Terry Egan.
At least two people, Ollie, have been rushed to hospital in Reading town centre. That's in the southeast of England. And they're being treated for knife wounds. Now, this was in the Central Park there. And one witness said that a lone person suddenly started shouting unintelligible words and went up to a group and started stabbing people. And he then ran out of the park, apparently. And one man has been arrested. Now, security sources even said that there have been three fatalities. But I stress this has not been confirmed by the police or the emergency services. Now, as I say, it happened in the park. And there was today a Black Lives Matter protest there earlier, but again, the police are keen to stress that there was no connection between the two incidents. Instead, the security services are saying that this is suspected to be terror-related and that the arrested man is Libyan. Again, no proof of that. But the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, has been commenting, and he said that his thoughts are with all those affected by the appalling incident.
Terry Egan. China has made no secret of its unhappiness at the failure of the Hong Kong authorities to end the unrest seen during months of pro-democracy protests in the territory. And so the communist leaders in Beijing have decided to impose a new security law on Hong Kong. On Saturday, some details were revealed, including the fact that it will override any conflicting Hong Kong legislation. Critics fear the law will undermine the deal allowing Hong Kong greater autonomy, agreed as part of the handover from Britain to China in 1997. I got more details from our Asia-Pacific editor, Celia Hatton.
For so long, Hong Kong has had its own system of laws. It's had its own partially elected legislature that has put through its own laws and regulations for decades now. It's had an independent judiciary. And now Beijing, in one short statement right at the end of this draft law, is saying, well, our national security law overrides anything that is already in place in Hong Kong. It's also the new law is saying that there will be an establishment of a national intelligence office in Beijing. Now, of course, Beijing agents have operated covertly in Hong Kong for quite some time. We know that. But this is just taking the mask off of that and making it much more overt that Beijing is extending its reach into Hong Kong and will be watching very closely what's going on there.
And what is likely to be the reaction, in particular, of the pro-democracy campaigners in Hong Kong?
We have heard from some of the big names, activists who've been watching this very, very carefully. And they're all basically saying what we've known for quite some time, that really this signals the end of an independent Hong Kong. There are a lot of vague parts of this law as well that we simply don't know. For example, we don't know what constitutes a crime under this new national security law. We don't even really know what constitutes national security. And that's really threatening. That's what a lot of analysts are pointing out, that if China can put anything under the umbrella of national security, really no one in Hong Kong is safe if they disagree fundamentally with something that Beijing is trying to do.
Now, the US has previously expressed concern about plans for this new law. Now the European Parliament has voted to take China to the International Court of Justice if it is imposed on the people of Hong Kong. I mean, what kind of pressure are we seeing from the international community, and what is China's likely response?
We are seeing, interestingly, a little bit of soft-stepping in Beijing. For example, some people thought that Beijing would have already pushed the law through by now, and they haven't done that. That indicates to me that they are listening a little bit to some of the pushback internationally.
And that was Celia Hatton. Pakistan is bracing itself for another attack of locusts as swarms from Africa and Iran arrive. Farmers across Pakistan are already reeling from the worst locust plague in recent history. The insects have caused billions of dollars in damage and led to fears of long-term food shortages. Umadraz Nangiana from the BBC Urdu service reports from Islamabad.
The moment locust swarms attacked cotton crops in a southern district of Pakistan's Punjab province. Panicked villagers beat their drums and banged utensils loudly, trying to scare the insects away. Most farmers here in Lodhra had never seen a locust attack before. Islam Khan was one of them. It looked like there was a storm coming. It was around 8 o'clock in the morning. But there were so many of them, they blocked the sun. The swarm was around 6 kilometers long and 2 kilometers wide. It took the swarm only 20 minutes to destroy 60 acres of Islam's cotton fields. He lost around 24,000 pounds in potential revenue. Seeing millions of locusts eating away at his newly planted cotton saplings, Islam Khan could only watch and cry. The moment when it was destroying my crops, it was very difficult to see it happen in front of my eyes. It felt like somebody was cutting off a part of my body. It's a scene that's been repeated widely across the southern half of the country. Hundreds of acres of crops have been destroyed in Balochistan and Sindh provinces, and locusts are now present in over a third of the districts in Pakistan. Disaster management authorities say they have so far treated more than 6,000 square kilometers of land with pesticides. In the next few days, locusts coming from Horn of Africa and Iran will enter Pakistan, further compounding an already complex situation. The government is exploring multiple options of getting rid of the locusts. One idea was tried 3 months ago in Okhara district of the country. Farmers there were asked to catch locusts, which the government then bought from them. Ali Sher availed of the opportunity.
The government officials here asked us to catch them alive, and they will buy it. We started catching locusts. My entire family got involved. Yet our losses were bigger. We sold it for 5,000 rupees, while the lost locust attack cost us was 200,000 rupees.
But such solutions have their limitations. For now, authorities in Pakistan have a race against time. They will have to act fast to protect cotton, rice, sugarcane, and other crops from millions of locusts,
those breeding inside the country and those coming from outside.
Umar Draz Nangiana from the BBC Urdu service in Islamabad. Still to come on the podcast.
It was always said that more people had walked on the surface of the moon than had been to the bottom of the deepest point.
But that has now changed after the son of the great ocean explorer Don Walsh followed his father to the bottom of the Mariana Trench. Officially, Zimbabwe only has 500 cases of coronavirus, including four deaths. But the reality is thought to be much worse. For an idea of the difficulties facing medical staff there, here's Dr. Noman Matara speaking to us a few weeks ago about the conditions in Zimbabwean quarantine centres.
We are concerned with sanitary conditions. People are being made to share very, very dirty toilets, ablution facilities, which are unhygienic, to say the least. Even the social distancing, they cannot practice social distancing as they are being made to sleep in one dormitory in some of the quarantine facilities, and they are sleeping closer together. We actually think that the virus is spreading within the quarantine facilities, as evidenced by the high number of positive cases that we've witnessed over the past week.
Well, now the effort to tackle the virus in Zimbabwe has been undermined by the arrest of the health minister. Obadiah Moyo appeared in court on Saturday charged with corruption over a multi-million dollar deal to procure COVID-19 tests and equipment. He was released on bail. I heard more from our correspondent in Harare, Shinganyoka.
It's very rare to see serving cabinet ministers in the dock. He arrived at the courthouse in his luxury state-issued vehicle in the company of his aides and didn't spend a lot of time there and was granted bail. And it is a surprise to many people. If you look, for example, at how some journalists have been treated over the last week, they've spent days in jail before they were awarded bail.
And just take us through the charges that he's facing.
Well, he faces three separate charges relating to the awarding of three contracts, one which dates back to March 2019. And all of these are for the supply of medical equipment totaling about $75 million. The last charge relates specifically to the supply of COVID-19 equipment. The prosecution says the minister unprocedurally awarded three companies, which essentially had the same representatives contracts for medical supplies. And when the first company failed a vetting process, the minister pushed that contract through. The representatives allegedly set up another company. And when that also was red flagged, the minister still went ahead regardless. And businessmen and two state officials have also been arrested in relation to these fraud charges.
And interesting that this came about following pressure on social media.
Yes, and it was sparked by government documents that were leaked to an online publication. And so over the last three or so weeks, the social media has been hive of activity with all of these documents, which appeared to show invoices of the supplies of this COVID material charged at three to four times their normal prices. And as a result of the social media, many people want to believe that's what has led to his arrest. And they're saying it's a victory for people power, but it still remains to be seen whether he'll be convicted on any of these charges. And that has been the criticism against Emmerson Mnangagwa's 2.5-year-old government. Zimbabweans have seen many high-profile cases come before the courts, and they've just fallen away. And there's a common phrase here, which is catch and release. And Zimbabweans are hoping that this won't be another instance of catch and release.
And what is the impact of the virus on Zimbabwe at the moment?
Well, as you pointed out, the numbers are still quite low, but there's a real fear now that the country is heading towards winter that those cases will rise. Zimbabwe is still under a lockdown and there are still fears that the worst isn't over. But what has really stung people generally is that you have these contracts awarded $75 million when many hospitals are struggling for basics such as paracetamol and bandages. Nurses and doctors have also been on strike over the last week because they say they don't have the protective equipment that they need to be able to do their job and that their salaries are insufficient. This really has been a slap in the face that these contracts can be awarded when the country is in such a desperate state and the health system is so fragile.
Chingai Nyoka in Zimbabwe. A Yazidi woman kidnapped as a teenager by the Islamic State group 6 years ago has finally returned to her family in Iraqi Kurdistan. More than 6,000 Yazidis, an ancient religious minority, went missing after IS swept through northern Iraq. Sebastian Usher reports.
The family of Halima Khalaf say they've been on her track for a year with the help of the office in Kurdistan dedicated to tracing Yazidis abducted by IS. Halima was 16 when she disappeared in 2014 as IS mounted a campaign of terror against the Yazidis, whom the jihadists condemn as heretics. Many Yazidi men were killed while women were taken as sex slaves. Halima was found recently in Turkey. Now she's been welcomed home by her family, more than 80 members of which also disappeared.
Sebastian Usher. Spain has agreed to allow in British travellers with no quarantine restrictions from today. It had already announced it would open its borders to EU countries, and the Spanish Foreign Minister said the UK was being added out of respect for the 400,000 British people with second homes in Spain. So far, the concession is not being reciprocated. Britain has a 14-day quarantine period for nearly everyone arriving from abroad, except Ireland. That may be reviewed in the coming weeks, though. Spain was hard hit by the coronavirus, with more than 27,000 recorded deaths. But it believes it now has the virus under control. And the tourism industry, which makes up more than a tenth of its economy, is hoping to make up lost ground. Guy Hedgeco reports.
I'm in the city of Toledo, which is perched on a steep hill in the plains of La Mancha. I'm in the central square of the city, and although all the bars and restaurants surrounding me are technically allowed to open with restrictions, the only place which is open at the moment, lunchtime, is McDonald's. Eventually, I find a small bar that's open called La Calle. It's just off the main square and run by José Manuel Rodríguez.
People are very reluctant to open up their businesses. In the old centre of Toledo, there are a lot of small bars with little space for outside tables. So they are businesses with 4 or 5 employees. The owners do the sums and think, I'd rather stay at home than have to be paying my staff.
Toledo is now in the third and final phase of Spain's staggered lifting of its lockdown, but the tourists are still staying away. And José Manuel says fears about the virus are still rife.
Some of my long-time customers pass by here and say hello, and they say, sorry, I'm not coming in. I'm scared. I'm scared of being in a place with people I do not know. There's a lot of fear.
But Spain is now preparing to reopen its tourism industry. On June the 21st, the country will stop imposing a 2-week quarantine on many visitors from elsewhere in Europe. Adelante. On the outskirts of Toledo, the Cigarrales Hotel is preparing to open up after more than 3 months of closure. An employee shows me the swimming pool, which is being filled up in the hope that tourists will come. The owner, Pedro Morón, explains that he's installing hand gel dispensers, that rooms will be sterilised after customers check out, and that he and his staff are all undergoing a public health training course on a recommendation of the government. I'm in central Madrid, in one of the best-known squares, the Plaza Santa Ana, and it's normally very popular with tourists. There are bars and restaurants all around this square. Certainly it's livelier than Toledo is at the moment. Most of the bars and restaurants are open. There are quite a few people out having drinks and eating, although the tables do tend to be quite spaced out. Some people are even wearing face masks as they sit there with their drinks. In a normal year, 80 million foreigners would visit Spain. But in 2020, a fraction of that number is expected. For now, at least, the country appears to have COVID-19 under control. Its challenge is to persuade the rest of the world that this is a safe place to visit.
Guy Hedgeco reporting. Like father, like son. Well, the ocean explorer Kelly Walsh has taken that expression to the limit by following his father to the deepest point of the world's oceans. His father, Don Walsh, reached the bottom of the Mariana Trench in 1960. Our science correspondent Jonathan Amos told me more about Kelly Walsh's landmark achievement in going down nearly 11,000 metres.
It was always said, Ollie, that more people had walked on the surface of the moon than had been to the bottom of the deepest point in Earth's oceans. Well, not anymore, because today Kelly Walsh brings the number of individuals who've been to this super deep point to 12, and that is the number of the Apollo moonwalkers. And it's really difficult, you know, to get down there. It's a long way down, as you said, nearly 11 kilometres. But the pressure difference between the surface of the ocean and the bottom is extraordinary. And you need a very special submarine indeed to be able to survive the crushing pressures. In many respects, you know, on that one scale, it's more difficult than going into space, because the difference, you know, to go into space is one atmosphere. It's, you know, going from sea level to a vacuum. But, you know, this is 1,000 times more pressure down there than it is at the surface. So, yeah, it is amazing.
And why do they do it? I mean, it's pretty extraordinary, but is there useful science to be had there?
Well, you know, going back to the 1950s, we had no idea really what lived in the ultra deep. The assumption was that nothing did. But over the years, you know, we've been sending subs down, not just crude subs like we saw today, but also landers where we drop cameras and instruments over the sides of ships, but also remotely operated and autonomous vehicles. And we're starting to understand that it's very diverse down there. And, you know, if we want to understand planet Earth, then we need to understand its full extremes. So we need to know what's going on in these trenches.
Jonathan Amos. The COVID-19 pandemic has touched so many parts of our lives, not even places of worship have been immune. But as lockdowns are gradually eased, churches are trying a new style of service, as Beth Timmins explains.
Borrowing from the drive-through successes of cinemas and takeaways, some churches are deciding to hold congregations in car parks, a novel compromise in the face of restrictions caused by a virus that has upended virtually every part of life around the world. Here in the UK, the Reverend Matt Timms of the Pentecostal Church in Cornwall, on the English southwest coast, has secured permission to hold a drive-in church service. His first application was rejected on the basis that it violated coronavirus restrictions. But he appealed, asking if drive-in cinemas were allowed, why not drive-in church services?
For some people, they were really missing that kind of connection point of actually seeing people. Many sort of older folk hadn't seen people in months. And it just moved my heart. And I kind of took it to our leadership team here and my wife. And we just sort of really felt, actually, wouldn't it be good if we were to see if we could do some sort of gathering where we can gather people together, we could still worship and people can interact with each other, but in a safe way that wasn't breaking any regulations.
Around the world, places of worship have been quietened since the pandemic began. At the Vatican, Pope Francis delivered Mass to an empty St Peter's Basilica on Easter morning. Mecca's Grand Mosque would have normally been full of worshippers during Ramadan, but stood largely empty. And people of the Jewish faith celebrated Passover online. But car park preaching has not been the only solution. Priests have been taking park bench confessions in the city of Warsaw in Poland, and in the Italian town of Taranto, one priest took his Good Friday procession to the roof so churchgoers could participate at a safe distance from their balconies and windows. Reverend Tim says there was strong engagement with the online services, but while he was running a community kitchen, he was hearing stories of people wanting more.
I think people were like, well, that's good, but actually there's nothing like seeing people face to face, seeing a smile, you know, they can jump in a car with somebody that they're bubbling with and come to the event and interact with people and interact with a message of hope as well.
He'll be setting up a stage in the car park with a large screen and live music for worshippers to sing along to in their cars.
A divine calling to the car park. I never thought my life would have taken this direction, but you just never know. A life of faith is exciting. And you just never know where it's going to take you next.
And car park congregations look to be a growing trend, with services already taking place across Canada, the United States and Germany, bringing their worshippers together at an otherwise isolating time.
Beth Timmins. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.
Hello there, I'm Ed Butler.
And I'm Manuela Saragossa. And we're the presenters of the Business Daily podcast from the BBC World Service.
Now, we have been asked to tell you all about our podcast and why you should listen to it. So, Manuela, what is Business Daily all about?
You know, Ed, that's a really difficult question because it does a lot more than it says on the tin. I mean, it talks about money, work, the economy, the office, the big policy issues.
Maybe we shouldn't be called Business Daily at all. Maybe we should have another name like In the Money, On the Money, With the Money. Here's Manuela with the money. That makes you sound like a drug dealer.
It does. Crystal ball gazing, I thought.
Oh, interesting.
Because we do a lot of looking at the future of work and industry. And curveballs as well, because we do throw our listeners some pretty random stuff, like how to be mediocre and still love yourself, or the business case for sleep.
Mystic Manuela, ahead of the curve. Okay, you lot at home, you get to decide. Give us a listen, tell us what you think, and perhaps tell us what to call ourselves.
Just look for BBC Business Daily wherever you download your podcasts.
Business Daily, then.
Business Daily.